Notes on the Folklore of Unseen Academicals by Jacqueline Simpson. Hunting the Megapode. Strange, yea, strange indeed, are the cherished traditions of Academe. Once in every 100 years, the midnight silence of Unseen University is torn by the clatter of hobnailed boots and cries of, "Ahoy, the Megapode!" Members of the senior faculty, each carried piggyback by a stout bowler-hatted university porter, are in hot pursuit of one of their number, who flees before them. He wears a special headdress, evolving a huge yellow and red beak, and utters doleful quacks. The explanation, insofar as there is one, is given by Ponder Stibbons, master of the traditions. "The original Megapode was found in the under-butler's pantry. It escaped in the middle of dinner and caused what my predecessor, 1100 years ago, called..." He referred to the book. "A veritable hey-ho rumbelow, as all the fellows pursued it through the college buildings with much mirth and good spirits. It is with great satisfaction that we can report that one of Earth's most respected academic institutions, All Souls College, Oxford, can boast of something very similar, the hunting of the mallard. It began, probably in Tudor times, as an annual custom, but later was reduced to just once in 100 years, being held in 1801, 1901, and 2001. Few of those reading about it today are likely to be there to see it in 2101. According to legend, workmen discovered this mallard in a drain while the foundations of the college were being laid in 1437, but it escaped them and flew off, and so the 14th of January was declared to be Mallard Night. The fellows and their friends enjoyed a lavish and prolonged supper, presided over by one of their number in the role of the Lord Mallard. Then at midnight they set out in procession, carrying lanterns and torches, and singing the Mallard song, to search every nook and cranny of the building, in the hope of finding their lost bird, from cellar to attic and beyond. In 1801, at 4 in the morning, an onlooker in a nearby college watched the proceedings from his garret window. "I had full view of the Lord Mallard, and about 40 fellows in a kind of procession on the library roof, with immense lighted torches, which had a singular effect. I am sure that all who had the gift of hearing within 1/2 mile must have been awakened by the manner in which they thundered their chorus, 'Oh, by the blood of King Edward!'" The chorus of the Mallard song runs, "Ho, the blood of King Edward, by the blood of King Edward, it was a swapping, swapping mallard." Nobody has any idea which of the various King Edwards is meant, or indeed why a king is mentioned at all. This very ignorance proves the traditionality of the tradition. The verses declare that other people may like to eat chicken, turkey or buzzard, but All Souls men must have their mallard. That this bird is more praiseworthy than the geese which saved the Roman capital, that when Jupiter went a-wooing, he became a swapping mallard, not a swan, and finally that the feasters should dabble, duck and dive into the punch-bowl, like mallards on a pond. But in the middle comes a verse which was omitted from the 1901 performance, though reinstated in 2001, and also deleted from 19th and 20th century descriptions of the custom, since it might upset persons of nervous disposition and refined sensibility. It makes clear that swapping means, well, large, obviously, but also exactly what anyone could guess that it meant. "He was swapping all from bill to eye. He was swapping all from wing to thigh. His swapping tool of generation outswapped all ye winged nation. Ho, the blood of King Edward," etc. Details of the performance have changed over time. In 1801, and presumably earlier too, the quarry was a man carrying a live duck. When he was finally cornered, the fellows cut off the bird's head and drank its blood. In 1901, they used a stuffed duck on a pole. In 2001, a wooden decoy duck. In 2001, the supper was less life-threatening than the 13 courses of 1901, and the procession did not clamber over the library roof, though it did still go up the tower. Yet the essentials remained. A fair amount of alcohol was consumed, and mirth and good spirits were displayed. May it still be so in 2101. Foot the ball. If football isn't about football, what is it about? As so often, people who enjoy something are too busy doing it to waste time talking about it, whereas those who disapprove are loud, persistent, and crystal clear in their objections. In the days when Earth's football was a wild, free game for dozens, if not hundreds, of players, as it was from the 12th century until about 150 years ago, those who wanted to ban it claimed that its main purpose was to hurt people. It is nothing but beastly fury and extreme violence, said Sir Thomas Eliot, 1531. A bloody and murderous practice, said the Puritan propagandist Philip Stubbs, 1583, adding, Doth not everyone lie in wait for his adversary, seeking to overthrow him and to pitch him upon his nose? Though it be upon hard stones, in ditch or dale, in valley or hole, he careth not, so that he hath him down. Sometime their necks be broken, sometime their backs, sometime their legs, sometime their arms, sometime one part thrown out of joint, sometime another, sometime their noses gush out with blood. They have slights to meet one man betwixt two, to dash him against the heart with their elbows, to hit him under the short ribs with their gripped fists, and with their knees to catch him upon the hip, and a hundred such murdering devices. A Frenchman, watching the mass football surging through the streets of Derby in the 1820s, remarked with awe that if Englishmen called this playing, it would be impossible to say what they call fighting. Yet young working men adored this game. They played it on Sundays, which was one reason why Stubbs was so angry, and on public holidays like Shrove Tuesday, crowds would come from miles around for an annual mega match, sometimes in open fields, but often in the streets of a city or town. A game could easily last all day. There were no rules and no limit on the number of players in each team. They would all gather at the town centre, and somebody would throw the ball into the middle of the crowd, which immediately turned into a tightly packed, heaving mass of bodies, shoving, kicking and headbutting at one another, while somewhere down out of sight, the ball might or might not be advancing slowly towards one of the goals. Today's rugby scrum is a faint, feeble image of this. The mighty sway or hug. Nobody cared whether the ball was kicked, carried or thrown. As for the goals, they were on the outskirts of the town, hundreds of yards apart, or even 2 or 3 miles, and could be anything from a pond to a pub or a mill. In some places, the idea was to carry the ball into your opponent's goal. In others, to keep hold of it and bring it safely home to your own. At Atherstone in Warwickshire, where the game is still played for several hours on Shrove Tuesdays in front of large crowds, the winner is whoever is actually holding the ball when a klaxon sounds to signal the end of play, never mind about goals. He keeps the ball as his trophy. In Cornwall, where the game is called hurling, the ball is made of wood or cork, painted silver, and is about the size of an orange. At Atherstone, it is 27 inches in diameter, made of leather, and filled with water. It weighs 4 pounds, so cannot be kicked far. In the bottle kicking on Easter Mondays at Hallerton in Leicestershire, there is no actual ball. Instead, there are 3 small wooden kegs, used 1 at a time. At Haxey in Lincolnshire, Humberside, the object for which the teams tussle is a hood, a kind of rolled-up leather truncheon. Legend claims that this represents a medieval lady's silken hood, which Haxey men saved when it blew away in a high wind. In several places, it is said that the game first began after a battle in which local men celebrated their victory by playing football with the severed head of one of their enemies. At Chester, they say these enemies were Danish Vikings, at Alnwick in Northumberland, the Scots, at Kirkwall in the Orkneys, where mass football is played twice a year on Christmas Day and New Year's Day, the story goes that their 12th century ruler, Earl Sigurd, fought the Scottish Earl, Malbricht, known as Tusker from his protruding tooth. Sigurd cut off Malbricht's head, tied it to his saddle, and rode home in triumph. But the tusk gashed his leg, giving him gangrene, from which he died. It is said that the people of Kirkwall were so furious that they kicked the head out of town. So what is football really about? It's not actually a battle, but it's definitely about being us, not them, about belonging. Though outsiders could join in, the teams were originally based on where people lived or what they did for a living. This parish against that parish, people from one end of the town against the other, uppies against downies, those born north or south of a particular river, farmers against fishermen, sailors against miners. In the sway or scrum or hug, or in Ankh Morpork, the shove, every man's strength counts, but no man is alone. He belongs. Just what are orcs, then? In every universe where orcs are found, accepted opinion declares that they are hopelessly, irredeemably evil. Accepted opinion, however, is sometimes wrong. We must wait and see. On the other hand, there is no accepted opinion as to what exactly orcs are, and how the race came into being. Are they a naturally occurring species of predator? Or were they originally more amiable creatures, who were deliberately corrupted by some evil power? Or did a great magician design and breed them to serve him in battle? On Earth, the unknown Anglo-Saxon poet who composed the epic Beowulf had a theory about the origins of various evil, monstrous beings, including the huge man-eating ogre, Grendel, whom the hero Beowulf had sworn to destroy. He believed they could be fitted into the history of the world as told in the Bible. They were all, he said, descended from Cain, whom God had cursed and driven away into the wilderness, because he had murdered Abel. From him were born all evil offspring, Ettins and Elves and Orkneys, and giants too who waged war on God. Ettins are a species of giant, elves we know, but what is an Orkney? The as is merely a plural ending. There is no other word like it in Old English. After some puzzlement, scholars decided that the first part must come from Latin, from the name of Orcus, the Roman god of death, a fearsome, devouring, demonic ogre of the underworld. The second part, ne, is clearer. It simply means corpse. Yet to grasp the whole meaning, we still have to decide which is the main part of the word and how the two parts are linked. Is ne the more important element, giving corpse from the underworld, as most interpreters believe? If so, the threatening creature is basically a walking corpse, what we would now call a zombie. This fits the grammar very well, but raises a logical problem. Can one really classify zombies as a non-human species, on a par with giants and elves, all genetically related by descent from a single ancestor? Surely they are simply humans who have died individually and who, for a variety of unfortunate reasons, have emerged individually from their graves. The alternative is to take orc as the main element, deathly creature, hellish creature, and assume the corpse is its prey. The great scholar J.R.R. Tolkien thought so. In his Middle Earth, orcs are loathsome goblins created by a magician to be an army. They are carrion eaters, devouring any kind of flesh, including humans, and perhaps even one another. And that is also what people on the disc believe about orcs. They came in thousands, like lice, killing everything and eating the dead, including theirs. The evil empire had bred them in huge cellars, grey demons without a hell. For the sake of pedantic thoroughness, it should be added that from the 16th century onwards, orque, orc, orca, or orch, was also the name for various real or imagined sea beasts, especially the killer whale. But we should not allow this to confuse the issue. Whatever people know or suspect about Mr. Nutt, they have never accused him of being a killer whale.